You are listening to Eon. AEON.net.au.
You are listening to the TER podcast, the Teachers Education Review.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Teachers Education Review. This is episode number 211. I'm your host Cameron Malcher and joining me for this special 2022 Year in Review episode are Stephen Kolber.
Hello, how we doing?
And Tom Marnie.
Hello.
Welcome, gentlemen, to the end of the 2022 school year. How have you finished up the end of your term four?
Yeah, as good as you can, right? Some people may know that the school that I've been working at this year has had its final year, and so it unfortunately closed its doors at the end of this year. But all in all, was a really great year to finish on. But there's a lot of sadness, a lot of grief in the midst of all that. But I think sometimes when you lose something that's quite close to you, you get to reflect a little bit more on what's special about it. So I think considering everything that's happened with the school, it's been a great experience to reflect on a school that's been a pretty special place for me. So,
and so I don't imagine this is an experience that many teachers have gone through, the actual end of a school. What happens? Where do the students and teachers move on to? Are there other schools opened in the area, or is this, you know, did a final year 12 group see their way out the door and that's the end of it? What actually happens?
Good question. We did finish at the end of the year, so the year 12s got to finish at the end of the year. In terms of that last term, it was really messy because we had teachers all over the place applying for positions, and we had students going to different schools. A bunch of schools in the local area opened their doors up and allowed for extra places, which was really kind. And so that was a really special thing to see. But in terms of teachers and teachers getting jobs, in terms of timing wise, for a school to close down, to try and find a job in a teacher shortage is probably a good thing. So all of the teachers didn't have too much of a problem finding something, although it was quite late in the year to try and find something maybe preferable. So I think our hands were sort of forced a little bit in terms of what we could approach and what we could, I guess, go for. But in terms of positions being available, there was definitely heaps there. So,
and because you were in an independent school, how was that decision actually made to close the school? Who takes responsibility for that decision?
It's a good question. Ultimately, the board makes that decision. And for good and bad, there was not much say in it from our perspective. So we really sort of just found out when the decision had been made, and we had to kind of take that on and go from there, which is unfortunate. It's not ideal. And I can understand why that decision might have been made, but I also, you know, some people have quite heard about it as well. So,
and so what does that mean for you for 2023?
That means that I'm moving to the state system. So I've got a job at a school in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, teaching maths and psychology. And yeah, it should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. Teaching year sevens and year 12s, which is a bit of fun. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, best of luck for it.
Thank you.
Stephen, what about you? What's happening for you at the end of the year?
Thankfully, things are slowing down. So it's kind of like for me at the moment where we're planning the launch of Keith and I's book, and sort of just starting to realize like, oh yeah, that's a real thing. It was very much the sort of thing that, you know, because it very much was a product of lockdown, and you know, it was all happened from the desk more or less.
Well, hang on. Let's not bury the lead there as Keith and I's book. You know, you've done something that many teachers dream of but few achieve, which is to actually edit and publish a book while working full time as a teacher. Let's tell everybody about the book in a bit more detail.
Sure. So it's called Empowering Teachers and Democratizing Schooling: Perspectives from Australia. If we had our way, it would be called Challenging Teacher Bashing, as the original Teach Meet was called. But for some reason, our publishers just weren't really vibing with that title. I can't remember if it ever made it onto the TER podcast or if the audio quality wasn't up to scratch, but it was definitely sort of floating around on the internet if anyone wants to hear various people talk to that theme. And, you know, I'm kind of giving away, you know, my year in review because it's always going to be the same thing, teacher bashing and teacher representation, think tanks, the media, all those sort of things. But the short blurb, not that anyone can afford to buy the book because it is an academic book, so it costs $250 is the cheapest version you can find. So I feel pretty happy trying to sell it because it doesn't affect me in any way if it is sold or not. It's basically a combination of about nine academic writing pairs and nine teacher pairs. A lot of people, you know, if you're in the online teacher space, people you'd be familiar with, writing about the themes of teacher empowerment and how we can do that and how policy can support us better and those kind of things. But yeah, so it's only just now this time of year where I'm like, oh yeah, the paper copies have arrived. They're sitting here on my desk and I'm like, oh yeah, that's the thing that we did. I was at lining up to get some turkey and ham at a Christmas party with my family. And one of my uncles sidled up and said, oh, you've got a book? I've got a book too. And then we had, you know, published an academic book talk. So, yeah, all of those things are a bit surprising for me because it's not something I would have seen myself doing either, but something wonderful to be sure, yeah.
And what else? What else marks the end of the year for you?
In typical fashion, you know, everyone else is relaxing and starting to unwind and I'm just sitting there strapped to my desk doing work like I always do. I don't know. I'm kind of that person. So the relaxing will come as soon as the final bell goes kind of thing. So yeah, lots of working right up to the bell and then it's full-time toddler care and expecting baby number two come sometime in April. So you know, enjoying peace while we have it.
Busy times. And, you know, speaking of which, I think all three of us, although Stephen, I think, how old's your first child now?
He turns two in Feb, so.
Yeah, so all three of us have, you know, children in the early, you know, I think, Tom, you've had your first child this year as well, haven't you?
Yeah, the other year. So
he's turning
two in March. So
we've all got two-year-olds running around. Yeah. Yeah. And we just had our third child like a month ago, 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, so, yeah, we've also what that's like.
We've also all got that going on for us as well, which has been a fun challenge.
Mm.
How have you found, how have you both found adapting to, you know, I've got, you know, a whole 2 years of parental experience above you two. So, you know, I'm hardly the wizened old man here, but how have you found adapting to first child with teacher life alongside it?
Yeah, I think the first year was, well, the first 7 months was pretty rough and that was basically a write-off. But then I found a groove and I was in a bit of a groove. And then we got closer to two and then things just got a little bit more crazy. And then Jess got pregnant and then it just got a little bit more crazy. And so, yeah, it's you know, it's like this exponential curve that's just keeps growing. So something's got to give. And I have actually decided to go on intermission from my PhD the start of next year. So, yeah, as much as I'd like to do all the things, something's got to budge. So
yeah, with a change of job, more children, and a PhD, it's totally understandable that something's got to take a break. And unfortunately, the need to earn an income or raise children can't really go on hold without dire consequences.
That's right. That's right. So that's me.
For me, it's very much I'm either on or off. If there's a toddler around, I'm off all things, which is not something I would have said of myself beforehand. And so that's been exciting. It's just, Yeah, for once it's kind of like as a teacher, you check your calendar and there's nothing that happens on the weekend normally. But now it's almost like, well, this is just socially acceptable, you know. No one's expecting you to go out or party or do anything, or, you know, it's like park question mark is what it says on Saturday, and then, you know, Sunday's like zoo question mark, and that's, you know, that's pretty much the range of social events that I get myself to.
Oh, very good. Very good.
And Cameron, how about your year?
Yeah, well, I was going to say my eldest is starting primary school next year. So, you know, we've reached that point where I now get to be the teacher parent. And, you know, there's that old sort of truism, or not even truism, I suppose it's just a cliche that the kids of teachers are either the best kids in the class or the worst. So I'm very curious, waiting to find out which one my kid's going to be.
Wait and see. We'll come back to you in another couple of months.
Yeah, you'll see the enthusiasm with which I'm willing to talk about it. But he's very excited. He's very keenly looking forward to it. He's had several days of, you know, his primary school have actually done a really good induction program. They've had several days and half days of getting to know the school and getting to know daily routine. So he's now very comfortable and confident with the school environment and excited to be going along, and he knows a few of the students who are there already now, so he's raring to go. We just have to wait and see how he goes with the actual day-to-day routine. You know, our son, his birthday's in March, and, you know, parents of children will be familiar with the agonizing decision of, do you send them early, you know, four turning five, or wait till they're five turning six, and we've opted for the four turning five. So we'll see how that goes, because he's still very much in some ways a four-year-old and still in many ways quite ready to start school. So we will see what the future brings.
All right.
Other than that, you know, my year, I have had quite the roller coaster of a year. Went back to teaching after a couple of years away working for a university. So starting a new, not only at a new school, but starting a new role that, after 20 years as a teacher, I find myself in a role I've never really done before. So, you know, two decades almost of experience become that feeling of being a novice again and having to learn a new skill, not learn a new skill set, but really focus on a skill set that's not been at the forefront of my teaching practice for a long time. So that's been an interesting and, let's say, humbling experience. Which has made life interesting. Like you, Tom, I've had to put my PhD on hold as well, though I was nowhere near as far into it as you are, because this new role that I'm in required a different qualification that I didn't hold. To be an EALD teacher, which is what I got transferred into, you have to have some sort of postgraduate TESOL qualification. So I had to put my PhD on hold to complete a TESOL certification. And I got to say, after teaching high school English for, as I said, the better part of 20 years, it was a bit embarrassing to realize just how little formal studies of grammar I've ever actually undertaken. Mm-hmm. And doing a TESOL certification and really getting into the nitty-gritty of English grammar has been an experience. So that's been sort of the end of my year. As much as my teaching has been a new experience, completing studies at university of topics that I really had not had as much experience with as I thought I had.
I remember that experience as well. Same thing. Masters of TESOL, thinking, oh, I've been teaching English for 6-7 years. I know what I'm doing. And then, you know, lecture one, it's like, all right, what are the word classes? And I'm like, you know, there's the capital letter one, the we don't have any of the meta language. And then they give you a grammar 101 textbook and you're checking the back for answers like a complete amateur.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if you've had this yet, Cameron, but then your Chinese students are saying, you know, well, the past, present, auxiliary, and you're like, yeah, no. And then the next lesson you're like, yep, got it. Yeah, no worries.
Yes. Yeah. What's the adjunct and what's the composition of the verbal group or the, yeah, it's just been an interesting learning experience. So yeah, I've had that a little bit, but not quite to that extent yet. Yeah. Well, look, let's get on with the topic of this episode. We're trying a new format this year with the three of us doing a year in review discussion. We're each going to look at a major story from the year ahead that particularly, from the year gone by, that still has implications going forward into 2023 and beyond. So we're each going to share a bit of information about a major story, something happening in education, either in policy, politics, or curriculum, and have a bit of a chat about the ramifications for teachers, for teaching practice, and for school policy going forward. So to kick us off, Stephen, why don't you tell us about your story?
Sure thing. As I said, I already killed my own story, but basically the thing that caught my attention, as it often does, is sort of the continuing depiction of teachers in the media. And so we had Nicole Mockler's new book come out, which is quite difficult to source, as I'm struggling to sort out myself. But she basically read, I think it was 20,000, I don't have the number right in front of me, but a very large corpus of research newspaper articles looking at the depictions or the kind of verbiage of teachers in the media. And for me, like the things that stick out to me most are probably the things that I've had, you know, a small part in. So I remember getting a call from a journalist probably early in the year. And it's sort of the more I've researched and studied the media depiction of teachers and how it all works and started to see a little bit behind the curtain, you can kind of see what they're driving at. So a journalist contacted me and said, have you seen any differences in your students after COVID? And as you know, to anyone that's taught or been anywhere around education, the answer is obviously, well, yeah. And like, how could there not be? You know, like, you know, you don't sort of just keep your young people in their homes in Victoria for, you know, close to 2 years and then expect them to come out the same. And so I was very effusive about the strengths that the students had developed, about their independence, their, you know, positive outlook and their, you know, maturity, basically, because, you know, these very young people had been asked to, like, well, if you don't want to do this thing, you don't have to do this thing anymore. And yet many of them still continued to and maintained almost what you could call professionalism, like they were still showing up to classes, albeit rather, you know, through gritted teeth, which is fair enough. And so, of course, then the article comes out and it's about student misbehavior arising problem. And I'm sort of thinking, well, I saw that one coming. And, you know, no matter how much you try and say, you know, because with any situation, there's good things and there's bad things, but it's, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, so to speak. And then, of course, we had the election coming around. And so then, you know, you think tanks were out in force and each side of politics were, you know, pushing very firmly that education is something to be fixed, returned to and so forth. And not surprising to anyone there, but always good, I think, to remember that brief moment in the sun that we often hark back to where teachers were positively shined upon for a brief moment in time when parents had to realize just how hard it was to look after young people. And then I just want to, you know, bring it more close to home. A recent study, the HILDA survey, which stands for Household Income and Labor Dynamics in Australia, which is a catchy one that rolls off the tongue. And it's, you know, surprised me, if no one else, in that in primary school, government schools are much more popular, which seems to, as a new parent, seems to sort of jive with the thrust of people, which is like, well, the primary school you send your young kids to doesn't really matter. But by the time you get to secondary school, all of a sudden it seems like we're all on my school and we're all, you know, working out what bands of rich, poor and middle class students are going where and how they're achieving and what the special programs are and all those sort of things. And in a very similar way, early childhood education, I've never really had a cogent conversation with anyone about what a good childcare centre looks like, other than, you know, some people said, oh, we went to one and we didn't like it, and so now we're in a new one. And similarly, primary school, not really much discourse about what makes a good or a bad school or childcare centre, Cameron. Tom, I don't know if anyone's had any different experiences to that, but it seems like, you know, if we're talking ideologies in education, it's like it doesn't even get going until you look at a secondary school gate in my, what I've seen around the traps, speaking to people and on the internet and similar. Any thoughts on that, people? Does that fit with what you've got?
Well, I mean, just anecdotally, it's certainly, and actually, Tom, you might be able to speak to this from your independent school experience, but you know, you look at K to 12 schools as an example, and a lot of people I know who've taught in K to 12 schools have significantly more students in the high school part of the school than in the primary school. You often even see, so even schools that propose to cater for students all the way through their education get a higher influx of students in the secondary years. Though, again, I repeat, that's just anecdotally. Tom, was that the case at your school?
I could add another anecdotal bit of evidence for you. That was the same at my school as well. Very much the secondary was where we had a lot of movement, we had a lot of interest, and the primary, yeah, it was quite low in terms of its numbers comparatively, yeah.
And I mean, just from people I've spoken to, there is always that sense that high school's the time to get serious about education, you know, and also high school's the time when other distractions might come along that need a stricter school environment to, you know, to take a hand in, you know, when as students start getting into relationships or getting to the age of experimentation or whatever else, whereas primary school, it's just kids learning. And I think also there's, you know, and again, anecdotally, hypothetically, but I think there's also the fact that at primary school age, you've got to be, most people would have to be particularly well off to be willing to and able to afford to pay the fees for a student to go to a non-government school, especially some of the higher end ones. When I say higher end, I mean higher end of fees for their whole time. And, you know, I used to live and work in the shadow of schools like King's and Tara School for Girls. And, you know, I know parents who would spend their child's primary school years saving and saving and saving so they could afford the fees of the more expensive private high schools because they just didn't have the income to be able to pay those costs from K to 12.
Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely. I guess when you look at it from that investment perspective, right, and that pre-university, pre-employment time is probably seen as that more important time of investment for those that probably see education more in that way, yeah.
Mm.
And just, yeah, so just sort of to tie it in, you know, not basically the trend is moving at the high school, year seven and above, away from government schools and towards the other sectors, particularly what's called other non-government schools, which is, you know, mostly your independent schools. And just kind of to me, the very clear narrative is just the same that it's always been, which is that the depiction of teachers. And for me, the main thing is like, you know, negative depiction is pretty hollow of an idea, but it's just the silencing or overlooking of teacher voices. So it's not at all uncommon. I was just controlling the urge to put, you know, 100 articles in front of us and saying, here's one where it's think tank and head of another think tank and head of university saying all these things, you know, and the title reads teachers ... and there's not a single teacher, neither hide nor hair, involved in the actual discussion at all. And I was really hoping, you know, all of this research coming out, teacher depiction, overly negative, Shine, Mockler, many others besides, that it's like, well, surely things will be changing now. But 2022 is not that year. Let's check back in 2023.
So I realize these are two separate stories, but do you see a relationship between the media representation of teaching and, you know, what the Hilda survey showed, which was the increasing number of parents going to non-government schools or sending their kids to non-government schools in high school years?
Yeah, absolutely. Like to me, and, you know, if I was doing a better job of my talking, that's what I would tie it off with. It's kind of the dominant narrative is very much teachers are failing in many respects, typically through testing and standardized tests and those sort of things. And that's pretty clear cut. But the difference being is that one, the largest sector, the government schools, don't have the budget to kind of counter that narrative with their own publications, their own research agencies, their own little think tanks, and so forth. And so then basically that's, to me, that's why the move towards those schools that can afford to advertise and, you know, say, yeah, things are failing, but unfortunately our wonderful school has Harry Potter style halls and teachers. We got the good teachers, you know, out of the bunch of rotten apples that come out of university every year, which, you know, it's good to be here with the rest of the bad apples bruised and beaten in the bottom of the barrel that we are here.
I see. Well, it'll certainly be. I mean, that Hilda survey, the last set of data was 2020, so it will be interesting to see in a couple of years' time if that trend has continued to grow, or if the COVID years have impacted people's ability and willingness to choose different schools for their kids.
Yeah,
I also wonder whether the change, the inflation rates and everything, will potentially maybe change that the other direction.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we just recently had a number of Christmas functions, and I have a few family members who work in various parts of the real estate industry, and the dramatic change just over the last couple of months in response to interest rates, particularly people who used to extend themselves to buy in particular school catchment areas. You know, those sort of things have notably changed just in the last couple of months while people are changing their borrowing and buying behavior. So it seems like it almost certainly will have some effect on school enrollments to a degree, but whether that's just a short blip on the radar or whether it's the beginning of a long-term trend will take a while to see.
Very true.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I mean, one final thought about this. What do you see as the implications for education going forward from both the studies that we've seen in the media and the trends in school enrollments?
To me, the trend is heading towards further stratification would be my implication that I'm drawing, I don't have I've read the research, but I haven't written the research to back it up. But it seems very much heading in that direction. And I know hopefully Tom will touch on the kind of the proposed changes to this. Just to kind of, foreshadow that, I had a lovely opportunity to speak to some of my initial teacher, soon-to-be teacher teachers, and I showed them some parts of the proposed changes to teacher recruitment and the teacher shortage, as we're all agreeing for it to be called. And we were in a course called Innovation, which is just rich with things for me to rail against. But they all said, these changes aren't especially innovative, except for the thing that jumped out was the kind of faster acceptance of teachers from other schools, because that is the clientele that I teach in that setting. There's just all these people. Yeah, I've taught for, 10, 15 years in India, and then I'm here sitting the land tight and, doing a course in Australia to prove that I can teach, which, of course has a whole bunch of contextual matters and issues attached to it. But I think there should hopefully be a way to for highly skilled professionals to help us with our teacher shortage. But anyway. Yeah, thoughts?
Interesting. Well, certainly something to keep an eye on for next year. I'm going to pick up here with my story because it has some direct connections to yours, Stephen. And it's the fact that not long ago, it was just late in November, I think it was like November 28 or thereabouts, that the federal government's Senate Standing Committee on Education and Employment References launched an inquiry into disruptive behavior in schools, with the plan for the inquiry to be reported back in July of 2023. Now, the inquiry was moved by the committee chair, who is Matt O'Sullivan. He's a Liberal Party senator from Western Australia, and he's only been in Parliament since 2019. So he's relatively new, got himself into a fairly decent committee chair position under the previous government and is still there after the change of government. Now, the motion establishing the inquiry claims that there is increasing disruption in Australian school classrooms, and I'm quoting here from the terms of reference, which is disadvantaging students and contributing to poor literacy and numeracy results for younger people. So they're making the claim that disruptive behaviour is directly contributing to poor literacy and numeracy results. And the inquiry is looking at issues like Australia's decrease in the OECD Disciplinary Climate Index, which is conducted as part of PISA every 3 years. They're also going to be looking at the impacts of disorderly classrooms on teacher safety, work satisfaction, and work retention, on teachers' views on whether they are sufficiently empowered to and equipped to maintain order in the classroom and what can be done to assist them. Now, those are just the first three dot points of 10 specific terms of reference, but the final reference is really open. It simply says any related matter, which means this inquiry is actually quite open in its scope, which is a bit different from some inquiries we've seen in the past, which specifically limit the scope of inquiry to shut out answers that the government kind of knows it doesn't want to hear. Perhaps the most famous example of that recently was Malcolm Turnbull's Gonski 2 review, which was specifically limited to looking at how existing funding could be used to greatest effect in lifting student outcomes, and was specifically prohibited from looking at the question of whether more money was actually needed to raise educational outcomes. So this review has a bit more of an open scope in that sense. Now, submissions to this inquiry are currently open. They close on the 31st of March, 2023. And at the end of this segment, I'm certainly going to have some suggestions for submissions that listeners may make if they want to, certainly some points to consider in responding to this inquiry if you hadn't already planned to do so. Now, this issue of classroom behaviour and its role in education is not new in the politics of Australian education, certainly not new in the last couple of years. As I said earlier, it's been an increasing topic since PISA introduced its assessment of disciplinary climate. Now, PISA, for those who have been living under a rock or may not be familiar, it's the program of international student assessment that the OECD conducts every 3 years, started around 2000 and is conducted every 3 years. The results then come out, you know, about a year later or a year and a half later after they aggregate and publish all of that data. Now, in 2009 is when they introduced the disciplinary climate review or assessment. And for the last couple of PISA rounds, Australian students or Australian schools have been consistently ranked towards the bottom of the list of participating countries. In the 2018 PISA study, Australia was placed in the 70th position of 77 OECD member countries. Funnily enough, the country ranked absolute last was Argentina, who just like in the weekend gone by won the Football World Cup grand final. Now, I'm not suggesting there's any immediate or direct relationship between those facts, but it's always interesting to invite consideration of what we measure, what we consider excellence, what we choose to focus on. PISA does have an evaluation of the number of days of physical education that schools offer students, but does it have anything that includes how schools foster the attitudes that lead to world champion sports players and that sort of thing? Instead of just classroom academic practice. So that's where the current discussion of the OECD PISA studies has started to inform Australian discussion on this topic.
So how does the PISA test evaluate the disciplinary climate. So I'm aware of PISA evaluating numeracy and literacy and that sort of stuff. I haven't really delved into the disciplinary area of it. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, it's mainly done by student responses to a survey. They ask questions about, you know, on a scale of infrequently to very frequently, how frequently, how often, for example, don't students listen to their teachers? Or how frequently is the classroom affected by noise and disorder, things of that nature. So it's all student perception of their classroom learning experience over a number of questions that address different aspects of what is an orderly, disciplined classroom and what's not. Now, the rationale for focusing on those student responses, you know, the opening paragraph of the PISA report chapter on disciplinary climate says this, and I'm just going to read out the opening paragraph. It says, people have different views on what constitutes a positive classroom environment, yet most people recognize an environment that is conducive to learning. One of the key components of such a learning environment is the disciplinary climate, or the degree to which noise and disorder are kept at bay. Students listen to what their teachers and other students say, and students can concentrate on academic tasks. So they're asking students their perceptions of classroom behavior and then aggregating those responses to create an index, a disciplinary climate index, where positive and negative results balance out to give an average of 0 with a standard deviation of 1. And then they look at, you know, and then when you look at the table in the report, you see schools ranked by who has the highest positive rating all the way down to 0. And then it continues to look at schools that have a net negative rating. And Australia, as I said, was 7th from the bottom with a overall negative rating of students saying most of the time there's disruption in the classroom.
Okay. So then according to PISA, Cameron, what factors contribute to student behaviour?
Well, here's another quote. And this is, again, a passage from Chapter 3 of the PISA results. They say, teachers have the main responsibility of ensuring that classroom environment is conducive to learning, and it quotes research relating to that. Students may feel that the school climate is negative and may double down on deviant exploits if they perceive that their teachers are unfair or biased in their interpretations of student behaviour. And again, it references research. However, previous studies have shown that the disciplinary climate also varies according to school characteristics that are largely out of teachers' control. For instance, socioeconomically advantaged schools typically have a more positive disciplinary climate than disadvantaged schools. And again, it references research. So as you can see, there's a pretty broad range of factors described there, from teachers' fairness and consistency of conduct in managing the classroom, to students' reactions to that teacher conduct, to those big picture systemic and socioeconomic factors of advantage and disadvantage and all the things that that brings with it. Now, this is where the politics of responding to this data comes into it. Because until this year's federal election, we've had a conservative federal government that primarily wants to focus on the teacher contribution side of the equation. And again, I refer back to, what was it, 2 or 3 prime ministers ago, we had Malcolm Turnbull and that idea of the Gonski review specifically not being allowed to look at the resourcing of education as a factor in educational outcomes. Instead, we've had this big focus on what teachers do and what teachers need to do to improve educational outcomes. Now, earlier this year, we had the acting minister, or then acting minister for education, Stuart Roberts, who, you know, I point this out at every opportunity. You know, he was acting education minister because the substantive education minister had to step down because he was being investigated over charges of workplace bullying and a number of other things. But then we had then acting education minister Stuart Roberts, who, when these results were published, he raised the issue of classroom behaviour and the need to address it in education. Whatever he had to say on the topic kind of got swallowed up in his generally not derogatory, but certainly dismissive and negative commentary on the status of teaching as a profession. You know, the phrase that I think most people associate with Stuart Roberts and his time as education minister was when he talked about dud teachers. He was saying that independent schools had great teachers and that they were doing great things, while dud teachers, as he called them, were in the public system where they were protected from being fired by horrible unions. Now, in the New South Wales state government, however, you know, after Roberts made those comments and was clearly focusing his narrative on teachers, the New South Wales state government, a bit later in the year, they also announced that they would be recruiting internationally for a behaviour advisor, for a statewide behaviour advisor. Interestingly enough, they've made the comment that they look to not only advise on teacher conduct and practice, but they're also looking at advising parents and carers on how to best support students at school. So there's the suggestion that they're also looking at community engagement and how schools and families interact to provide more support for appropriate, you know, classroom behavior from students and young people. And they also announced that they're planning to increase the number of behavior specialists working in schools up to 200, which are there to support schools in addressing complex behavior needs. So the New South Wales government are certainly taking a more broad approach, but in those examples, we're still seeing primarily a focus on the behaviors, the teacher behavior in the classroom with support from community, not a lot of discussion still about those big picture issues of socioeconomic advantage and disadvantage and their contribution to disciplinary climate. And the reason I mention that particularly is the other thing that PISA has shown, and, you know, we've had a number of, we've had some podcast interviews, we've had papers published, and the PISA results, you know, alongside the disciplinary climate have shown that Australia has the fourth most stratified education system in the world. And this is where it's interesting to consider this in the context of the Hilda survey, because that increasing drift towards secondary independent school enrolments is part of that increasing stratification, where advantaged and disadvantaged students are being concentrated into different kinds of schools. Now, that is a particular issue for disadvantaged students because, as has been said loudly and often, concentration of disadvantage is itself a disadvantage, which can exacerbate issues like student behavior and their impact on education. So as our education system becomes more and more stratified, we are making things harder, both in terms of learning and classroom behavior, for students at the more disadvantaged end of that spectrum. So, you know, can, and then this is a question I often find myself asking of people I interview on this podcast, can classroom teacher behavior and teaching practice be enough to overcome the systemic issues? Can a teacher in front of a class of 30 students from socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds with behavior issues, can one teacher's conduct overcome the fact that the system has chucked those 30 kids together in a class rather than a mix of advantaged and disadvantaged students to learn from and bounce off each other? Now, the other thing that's interesting about this survey, and this is something else that was mentioned in the terms of reference, is the impact of classroom behavior on teacher well-being and retention. Because we've seen a number of other studies published that have shown that it is having an impact on the teaching profession. You know, we've got the Principal Health and Wellbeing Survey, which year after year shows principals being subject to increasing, in some cases, physical violence or just aggression from parents and the community. And often that's used as a bit of an indicator of the whole school experience and climate. You know, principals are obviously in a pinnacle position where they are target number one for particularly challenging issues. But if principals are being assaulted and subject to abusive behavior, then what's happening to the teachers? And we also had the Monash Perceptions of Teachers and Their Work survey, which over a couple of different surveys, you know, and we've had Fiona Longmuir and Amanda Heffernan on this podcast to talk about this study in the past. Those surveys have shown between, I think it was from 19 to 24% of teachers say they don't even feel safe at work because of issues like extreme student behavior. Now, those obviously go beyond just disruptive classroom behaviors that affect learning into the realm of actual, you know, violence in the workplace and workplace safety. But if you put them all under the banner of behavior, there's multiple sources indicating we have a growing problem of behavior and conduct towards teachers leading to lack of feeling safe, lack of workplace morale, potentially lack of student achievement. So it's interesting that we have this federal survey, or not survey, inquiry, I should say, now launching to look at the issue more broadly. Of course, like all political inquiries, it will also be interesting to look at the balance of submissions made to it and exactly what is being said in those surveys. We had a Stephen, you might be able to help me with the numbers here, but there have been reporters who have looked into the responses to previous educational inquiries and found that there are people out there buying mass submissions from international click farms to send thousands of copy and paste responses to surveys or to government inquiries, only for the government to then turn around and say, well, look, we got 10,000 surveys saying this, therefore that's the direction we're going, and discounting the fact that someone's paying for those responses to be sent. So whether this inquiry is subject to the same behavior is also something we'll have to look out for.
That's interesting. Cameron, I'm wondering about what you think the role of the teacher in all of this is. Like, what's the point of the teacher in relation to the behavior?
Well, I mean, someone whose name gets bandied around a lot in discussions about school discipline is Tom Bennett, who is a UK government behavior advisor and also the head of he's sort of the figurehead and leader of the Research Ed organizations. And I mean, he says one thing that I genuinely agree with, which is that behavior needs to be taught. Behavior is a curriculum. And, you know, we all know as teachers this idea of establishing expectations and managing expectations and behaviors in the classroom. The teacher plays a big role in establishing and teaching those desired behaviors. I mean, and this is something to reflect on, and certainly something that I've been reflecting on this year as I find myself in a very different teaching context, is just how explicit are we in the kind of behaviors we expect? You know, and I'll give you one example. You might see discussions online of the acronym SLANT being used, and SLANT stands for, I'll see if I can do this from memory, you know, sit up straight, lean forward, ask questions, nod your head, and track the speaker. And it's meant to provide a framework for academically engaged behaviors, you know, to have students sit up, not be slouching in their chair, not be leaning back, to be leaning forward with their pen in hand over their note paper, ready to actually engage and take notes, to act, you know, actively ask questions, to elaborate, to clarify, nodding head simply being to engage and to acknowledge that the teacher is, or the speaker, not necessarily the teacher, maybe it's a student speaker, to acknowledge what's being said, and track the teacher, meaning simply actually follow them with your eyes. You know, because if a student's looking off to the side reading a poster while the teacher's giving instructions, or a student is providing a response, well, they're not fully engaged. Now, some people see that as an unnecessarily strict, or maybe not even strict, but an unnecessarily detailed way of engaging or instructing students in behavior. But there are also students who have never, like simply never been given any guidance on what's an appropriate way to behave in a classroom. And sometimes you need to start with that degree of basics. And again, it's that idea of knowing your students and the degree of instruction that they need. But behavior does need to be taught. And the teacher plays, in my opinion, a fundamental role in teaching what is expected and acceptable classroom behavior. But then the hard part, of course, is being consistent and fair in maintaining that. And, you know, I'd be surprised if there's a teacher out there who hasn't had a student say, "Oh, it's not fair. Why are you always picking on me and not that kid down the front?" And when you give them a response like, "Well, because that student may be talking, but when it's time to do their work, they get on with it and do their work. You're talking while you're meant to be doing your work," you know, and finding ways to make that kind of conduct fair, and more importantly, appear fair to students is one of the big challenges. You know, Stephen, I know you're in the position of teaching pre-service teachers at the moment. Does anybody still talk about the notion of not smiling till Easter? Is that still
just heard that at my new school like only a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And these are the kind of ideas of, you know, it's, you know, when people say don't smile till Easter, it sounds, you know, very matronly and very conservative. But at the core of it, what it means is it's easier to be, once you relax an expectation, once you relax on discipline, it's almost impossible to get it back. You know, you've got to establish the rules and be strict with them and set a culture and set a series of expectations before you start to relax a little bit. Now, that obviously depends on the students you're teaching. Every student needs to feel like they matter and feel like you care about them and their learning. So if you're coming into a classroom in a disciplinary way that says to students, "All I care about is your behavior, not you," then you're already starting to lose the battle, in my experience and opinion. But the word I always use is culture. The teacher plays a leading role in establishing the culture of a classroom, because if the teacher turns a blind eye to that one student that's always a challenge, the message they're sending and the culture they're establishing is, to some degree, that's acceptable. And striking that balance of expectations is part of the teacher's role, and it's really hard to do, especially when you have students who have actual behavior challenges or actual emotional difficulties that manifest in behavior. Because if you're teaching year seven or if you're teaching primary school, not all students will have the emotional maturity to recognize that person needs special care. What many of them just see is, it's not fair. That person gets treated differently to me. And that's the juggling that a teacher has to do every day, is juggling the needs of the students to make sure they appear fair. Because as it said in that OECD report, students will often respond to the perception of unfairness with worse behaviors or with further behavioral problems. So, you know, that's where the teacher comes in. But it is, if you don't have a class of students who already know how to behave in a classroom and already value engaging in school processes, then that can be one of the most challenging parts of a teacher's job, in my experience.
See, to me, what springs to mind, and this is probably going back to the PISA point, is a different meaning, a different version of the word culture, which is just the concept of comparing classroom climate across countries is just such a fascinating to think. So, Cameron, you said 77, if I've got my numbers right. So that's 77 different countries, quite likely at least as many or close to as many languages. Each of those concepts, disorder, quiet, silence, you know, like if you said to every teacher in your school, what does a silent classroom look like? What does a productive classroom look like? There'd be slight gradations, let alone across countries. And to me, that's where it gets really interesting because, like,
absolutely.
You know, as a parent myself, I'm sure, like, my vision of a school isn't that my students sitting there following your slant principles and, you know, imbibing knowledge without having a fair crack back or, you know, those sort of things. So I don't know. There's a real, like, Australian culture. What do parents expect? What do students expect? What do teachers expect? I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot in there.
But, and in that, I think what's also worth noting is the relationship between where countries rank in that disciplinary climate and where they rank in academic results. Because, you know, Australia ranked 70th out of 77 countries, but was much higher in, you know, we're still, you know, we talk about declining results in the PISA standards in it for Australia, but we're still in the teens or low 20s for achievement, whereas countries that are much better, have much better disciplinary climates, aren't necessarily ranked that highly academically. And to give you an example, you know, Finland has for a long time been talked about as one of the leading countries in PISA, and I think still they're in the top five. I think third, but I'm you know, don't quote me on that. Where do you think Finland ranked in disciplinary climate?
I reckon.
Do you want to take a guess?
Third would be my guess.
I'm gonna go 53.
They were seven. They were seven places above Australia at 63.
That's
class. So, you know, these relationships of disciplinary climate to achievement are not as clear cut. You know, this review just sort of states that poor behavior is affecting literacy and numeracy, yet some of the highest achieving countries in PISA are also very low ranked on the disciplinary climate index. Of course, that means there's more to be teased out and it's far more complex than simplistic tables and rankings can tell us. But that is kind of what you're saying, Stephen, you know, and that's why I think the survey's focus on student perceptions is an interesting way to do it, because regardless of what the cultural norm is, you know, if you've got a class or a school, even just a classroom where very active conversational dialogic learning is the norm, but everybody feels engaged, then when they get asked a question, am I able to concentrate on my learning? They're going to say yes, as opposed to, you know, it's not like they're saying, it's not like the survey is asking questions saying, do I sit for 50 minutes at a time writing quietly? Because that is not an indication of engagement in learning. We know that kids can do that and not remember or learn a damn thing. So that's why I think those student perceptions and the framing of those questions are an important part of bridging that exact thing you mentioned, Stephen, because what matters is, does the student feel like they are being given the opportunity to engage in their learning regardless of what the normal conduct for that classroom actually is.
And I'll just add as a sort of an asterisk side point, the OECD in their wisdom, they've sort of added to their, because everyone, you know, PISA is sort of the very much their main offering, but they did something called the Global Teaching Insights Video Study. That's basically, they got a whole bunch of teachers around from obviously OECD nations to film their classes. So if you're a leader working with teachers, and often it's very difficult to get people to volunteer to film their own classes or things like that, you can kind of take teachers, as I have with my teachers, to be on a bit of a tour of the world of kind of teaching practice and what it looks like in these countries, to kind of put a bit of kind of meat on the bones. Because, like, you know, going through, you know, Australia is 70th and 77, but to actually see what it looks like and what the kind of context of all of these interventions and where they might be happening in the world is a really interesting thing to do, especially, you know, as we're not especially able to be flying around the world. Definitely something to pull up for those who are interested in teaching around the world, for sure.
And look, I just wanted to finish with one point though, because I did say I had some thoughts on submissions to the review. And this is where I think it dovetails nicely with your reference to the Hilda survey, Steve, because something that I think we need, you know, anybody who feels so inclined and has the time to draft something appropriate, I think that we do need to make sure that behavior is looked at in terms of that socioeconomic stratification, that idea of disadvantage being a disadvantage that gets compounded upon itself. Because if Australia doesn't address the underlying issue of its stratified education system, then a lot of these problems, I expect, are just going to continue to be compounded upon themselves. And I think the inquiry needs to look at, and I'm sure there are, I have no doubt there are academics who will be making submissions about where these issues of classroom discipline are most concentrated, and that we need to, you know, make sure that part of the voice, part of the response to this survey is looking at behavior in context of our stratified education system and the spread of socioeconomic disadvantage across our schools. It's such a big systemic piece. And, you know, again, Australia has the fourth most stratified education system in the world. So it should come as no surprise that we are finding increasing challenges and difficulties, particularly in the bigger concentrations of disadvantage in our education system. So that's what I will be spending part of my holidays researching and drafting, will be a response to the survey saying, well, hang on, let's look at the systemic issues underpinning discipline, not just, and that's not to say not to look at teacher conduct and other cultural and social issues, but let's make sure that our education system is not itself a barrier to effective learning by concentrating disadvantage and behavioral problems in an increasingly residualized public education system. Right. Well, let's move on, Tom, to our third and final story. What have you got for us?
Great. Well, I wanted to just briefly talk a little bit about the new National Teacher Workforce Action Plan, which only got released on the 16th of December, not too long ago. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, I guess, the differences in terms of what we've seen from previous education ministers to what we've got at the moment. And then just talk a little bit about some of the good things about the action plan and maybe some of the things that are lacking that have been talked about in previous podcasts and various blogs and that sort of thing, and just kind of to add to that conversation a little bit. So if you're not aware already, we have a new educational minister, Jason Clare, and what's quite interesting about him is the difference in discourse towards teachers that he has been making through media, online, through social media and that sort of thing. In particular, the consideration of what we've called the teacher crisis. We've already talked about it a couple of times already in this episode. But in trying to address that issue, Jason Clare has decided to create a working group to develop a national teacher action, workforce action plan, which has recently been released. And so as part of that, he engaged the community to basically provide some submissions for feedback on the action plan and everything as well, which supposedly went into the changes for the revised edition. So the draft came out earlier in the year. I don't specifically remember exactly when. Do you guys remember? Was it August 3rd or something?
Oh, you're stretching my memory there, but I just remember the middle of the year.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, the draft plan was brought out a little while back, a few months back, and they've just recently released the official National Teacher Workforce Action Plan. And I'm just having a look now, and of the some 300,000 full-time teachers we've got in Australia, there were 661 submissions for feedback on this action plan, which I think gives an impression of just how much time teachers have to really engage politically with the kinds of discourses that are impacting on their practice. But look, let's get into, I just want to chat briefly about those three things. So firstly, what is different to now to what we've experienced maybe in the past? I want to talk and highlight just a little bit about our previous education minister, Alan Tudge, and over COVID and over the times that he was in that role, he really had this tendency to shut down and silence critics. And I know of many teachers and people involved in education that were blocked by Alan Tudge on Twitter for whatever comments or critiques they made. Yeah, there's a few people we know. I think we can all say we know somebody. And it was quite interesting to see the way that Alan Tudge's social media was really often highly curated. And further to this, it was sort of mentioned about think tanks. A lot of his policy directions seemed very, very aligned with certain think tanks. And you can almost directly align some papers by the Center of Independent Studies and some of Alan Tudge's media releases. Word for word, you can take those policy directions out of there. So that's where we've come from. And what's interesting is if we've got a current education minister, Jason Clare, who from the outset seems to be promoting a more democratic approach. And so the creation of a working group to discern what needs to be done in this teacher crisis, as well as opening up the draft plan for community consultation, it gives that appearance that there's more democratic processes going on to address this issue. And so I think that's positive. It's not totally, we're not in some sort of wonderland, but at the same time, it's been mentioned that there is a subtle shift in the discourse surrounding teachers and education. And I think that's a really, really positive sort of place that we can sort of sit ourselves in at the moment. Now, just thinking about the action plan that's recently been released, I want to just touch base on a couple of positive things that I've picked up from this. Now, there are plenty of other positives I'm sure others can pick up, but these are the little ones that I've had a look at. In particular, I've noticed that there's an acknowledgement that there needs to be more permanent roles in government schools. And I've spoken to many teachers who have been on the bad side of the casualization of teaching employment in Australia. And the need for competitive behavior in our teachers is often driving them away. And I think that's a really positive thing to see that being addressed. There is a whole priority area which is on keeping the teachers we have, which from our previous education minister, that was not on the table. It was all about getting new teachers that are better. And I think that's really, really important that we're seeing this subtle change in discourse. It's a bit unclear about how the initiatives will address these issues. And there is talk about a workload reduction fund. And my question would be how that is actually going to be used. There's not really much information about that. So there has been a bit of talk recently about the idea of quality lesson plan banks, which is something that there's quite a bit of critique about. And so it'll just be interesting to keep an eye on that. I think when we look at the way that it talks about the National School Reform Agreement coming up and looking at the way that those initiatives impact on teacher workload, I think that's really, really positive. There's some moves away from more tokenistic gestures for elevating the teaching profession. So that initially in the draft, there was that suggestion for a teacher's award.
Which, the best teacher of the year award for Australia kind of thing, Australian teacher of the year or something like that.
And there was they copped a bit for that. So they did change that, which I think was really positive. And one thing that I'm particularly interested in is this commitment to teach clause for individuals who receive Commonwealth bursaries. So for new teachers that go into the profession. So there's potentially, I think it was 5,000 lots of 40,000. So if I'm doing my calculations correct, that's around $200 million on the line. Please let me know if I'm wrong on that one. But that's a lot of money. So I haven't been convinced that these bursaries would make any difference to increasing the retention of our teachers. rather than getting people a nice qualification and maybe getting them to teach for a couple of years. But there are issues within the system that are still being left unaddressed. And so just before we finish up, I want to talk about maybe some things that I see as lacking in the official final action plan. And it's a bit of a bold statement, but in my opinion, I don't really see any real change being made. So I don't necessarily see any reversal of bad prior policy. There's still a continuation of the high achieving teachers program and land type, and these initiatives that are questionable in terms of their outcomes and whether they're actually meeting the desired outcomes that they were sort of promoted to achieve. And so rather than addressing those issues, they've just been seen as part of the program now, and so we're just continuing on with those. And further on with that continuation, there's still a continuation of attacks on initial teacher education as a problem. This whole idea of determining some arbitrary quality teacher, a classroom ready teacher, if you will, which is very problematic in many ways. I think as well throughout this, there's this perceived ignorance of the systemic issues that are making teachers leave. So accountability and measurement and pay and all those things that we've been talking about for years are put aside in relation to this particular action plan. And if you have a look at the initial foreword for the official action plan, they do state, "We recognize the importance of fair pay, conditions, job security, and boosting respect for the profession as key parts of attracting more people to teaching and keeping the teachers we have in the classroom." So it's acknowledged and it's recognized, but it's not necessarily enacted maybe fully. There's also no indication of addressing the difference between state and private schools. And we've talked a little bit about some of what's happening in Australian schools at the moment and the differences there. And there's no indication that that is being addressed as an issue in this case. Lastly, I did notice that the raising the status and value of the role of the teachers has actually moved to a lower priority list from my perspective. In the initial draft, it was the first thing on the list, but now it's dropped to the fourth out of how many are there? I think there's five.
What's taken that first place?
Improving teacher supply.
Mm.
So once again, this whole thing about we need to get new teachers, we need to get better teachers. So the first two, improving teacher supply and strengthening initial teacher education. So those two tell me that the most important thing is that we get new teachers in. And so I find that interesting and maybe reflective maybe of the complexity of that actual objective. To raise the status and value of the teacher involves a lot more than a $10 million marketing campaign, in my opinion. I find it really interesting in the elevating the profession. So the $10 million they're putting towards to highlight what good teachers do, I think it's indicative of a learning theory, an understanding of the way learning happens and how people develop characteristics and dispositions and perspectives. I think it's very simplistic. It's basically saying, if we just put enough information out there about how good teachers are and in the media, then people will just lap it up and people will accept it. And it's a very traditional way of thinking about education, about learning, is that all you've got to do is just fill people's minds with the right information and then all will be good. But I think it's a lot more complex than that. And I think this action plan actually acknowledges this maybe subtly, not necessarily out loud. So those are my thoughts. And I thought I'd finish off with a quote from Fiona Longyear in a recent interview she had with Cameron, sort of talking about the draft and national teacher workforce. It's a bit of a mouthful, that thing. But she said that we're pouring water into a bucket that is filled with holes. And I think that's very reflective of this action plan. I think there are some really positive things in this, and I think there's some positive changes in discourse, but there is still an what's the word? I guess we're not really recognizing maybe the core issues at play here, and maybe looking at things that are a little bit more simple.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You talked about like the potential limitations of something like the bursaries. But one of the things that's interesting with this approach that Claire is taking is that as federal minister, you know, the federal government doesn't hire a single teacher in the country because state and territory governments have the constitutional mandate to manage education. So they have very few levers they can pull as the federal government. It's either attaching buckets of money to certain changes or getting agreement between all the state and territory governments. And, you know, I think back to when we last had a federal education government that put through the Gonski initiatives, and you know, you may remember Julia Gillard was on the news flying all over the country desperately trying to get agreement between all the state and territory governments to get sign up to Gonski before a certain deadline. And I believe at the time it was Western Australia that was the really holdout Liberal Party state at the time that really took it close to the wire before finally signing on. And you think about the situation we have now where we've got a federal Labor government and all but one state governments are Labor. And so the notion of getting agreement on these kind of policies will be very different to the last time we had a government trying to push this kind of national strategy for education.
That's a very interesting point, yeah.
Yeah, but the other thing that you said there that, you know, I think also relates to Fiona Longmuir's quote, the idea that the bucket is filled with holes. And I think the fact that existing policy is never up for review, you know, you mentioned land tight and some of the other things, but, you know, one of the questions that I always want to pose whenever I hear somebody talking about how Australia was in the top five of PISA back in 2000 is, well, if you want to get back to the results of 2000, why aren't you winding back policy to the state of things in 2000? You know, we didn't have NAPLAN, we didn't have, we didn't have things like land tight, we didn't have teacher salaries falling so far behind similar professions. But, you know, just that idea that existing policy is never up for review, even if it was implemented by a different government, even if it was implemented by an opposition government. It's just never, and that fascinates me, because how can you claim to be data-driven if you're not willing to look at the data of your own initiatives?
And then the response is, well, we just haven't done it well enough, and we need to keep pushing with this thing. This is a good initiative. We're just not doing it well enough, which is quite interesting. How that continues on, especially the high achieving teachers and the HALT certification as well is an interesting one. I think there's 2,000 certifications out of 300,000 teachers, something like that. That's enough to tell you that it's probably not worth continuing. But the discourse is, we just need to keep going with this. We just need to make it less burdensome. But it's a good thing, and it's interesting. It subtly makes the suggestion that our teachers are not good enough until they get this thing, which. Yeah.
The other thing, and this brings us all the way back to Stephen's first story about teacher bashing, and you know, just picking up on what you said there, Tom, that the narrative is always what do teachers need to change about what they're doing? You know, we also. There's that old saying, show me your budget and I'll show you what you value. And all of these initiatives are relatively low cost. You know, a $200 million bursary fund, you know, it's a lot of money, but in terms of the federal government's annual budget, it's very small overall. But the things that you know, one of the things that often comes up is the fact that when we talk about teacher workload and retaining the workforce, that Australian teachers have one of the highest face-to-face teaching workloads of comparable school systems, while other systems have more time for preparation, planning, collaboration built into the school day. And, you know, I think the best common example is Singapore, where they have much larger classes, but then teachers teach far fewer hours, so they've got more time for planning and assessment, and also have a very different school and cultural engagement with education, of course. But to make a change like significantly reducing face-to-face teaching hours, that's going to cost big dollars. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to say across the country, we want to reduce every teacher's face-to-face teaching workload to 50% of their teaching job, of their teaching hours, that's going to cost billions. And I think that's why we never see those things being proposed. It's always the here's a bucket of money to try and tweak a small amount. And you know, you mentioned HALT certification. Most jurisdictions have some increased salary for HALT certification, but it's very small in the overall staffing budget. You know, those big things we just never see floated because they will cost billions of dollars. And that tells us the priority is tweak teacher behavior as long as it doesn't cost too much.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I guess it tells you a little bit about what's valued in education, making sure it's value for money, which is, it raises the question, should education necessarily give an investment that's equal, or like an output that's equal to your input?
Well, if I've understood your segments for the past year and a half, we're talking about the social efficiency ideology and the way it influences education.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're talking – I think I heard a bit of an input-output model in Stephen's talk. I was just like, I'm just going to hold back. But
it's almost like – so to me, this draft looks relatively schizophrenic because you've got the idea of, you know, well, the teachers aren't that good, so we need a land-type test, which is, you know, a bar that they need to be able to step over. You know, it's a low bar, basically. And then you've got your HALT, which is saying, but also, you know, they need to be better as well, and also saying, like, well, we need more teachers, so we're going to get some of them from overseas. But also our own ones need to be better, so we're going to advertise to them. Like, it's very – it's trying to do a lot of things at the same time. And as you say, a lot of policies, it's like they kind of open their barrel of policies and go, oh, well, there's still that HALT one that we've been doing for the last 5 years. It hasn't really taken off. Maybe we should do that again, but this time it will take off. And then, you know, like I said, working with some teachers-to-be, the word land tight was there, and they're like, oh, we're getting rid of land tight. And then, you know, you read the fine print and it's like, well, instead of waiting till the end of the first year, they can do it before they start their course. And then if they fail it, then they can do it again and then do it again and do it again. So, I mean, you know, if you're in the education space and you want to make some money, start a land tight training school or a land tight testing school or anything with those letters in it, I reckon you're in a similar situation, the one Cameron is in now, studying, you know, teaching EAL, and down here at in Victoria, seeing people line up massive lines all the way down multiple blocks to sit their IELTS test so that they could get entry into a university. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, someone is in there, $500 a test. I think Landtite's similar pricing, about $500 to sit the test. You just think, yeah, someone is making quite good money out of, in the land tides case, people that want to be teachers, and in the IELTS case, people that want to be, students in Australian universities or high schools, secondary schools, whatever it is. There's some seriously money being made off these sort of policy proclamations. So that's my hot.
It's very interesting. I think ACER are responsible for Landtite, and I had a look at one of their recent financial year reports, and they're making revenue of around $90 million a year, something like that. So they're doing pretty well. And, maybe they don't want to say goodbye to that. Maybe there's a...
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's so we've got a few things to look forward, maybe not look forward to, but to look out for in the new year, looking for exactly what manifests in terms of state and federal government agreements coming out of the draft workforce plan. We'll be keeping an eye out for the published submissions to the student behavior review and, of course, paying attention both to media coverage of education and the long-term trends in school enrollments to see if those trends continue or if indeed, you know, people paying attention to it makes a difference. Though I suspect, you know, ever since this current Labor government got in, there's been a lot of talk on social media about the hope for a media royal commission. And I suspect that issue of teacher bashing might go hand in hand with the outcomes of a media ownership royal commission. But again, we'll wait and see. Thinking ahead for the year to come, Tom, you've mentioned at the beginning, you've got a new school, a new position to settle into. What else lies ahead for you in the new year?
Yeah, well, we've got a new baby coming in Feb. So, yeah, so I'm in a similar boat to Stephen. I think I'm going to be very sleep deprived for the majority of the year and should be good. Now, there's a few more changes than I was expecting, but that's okay. That's okay.
And new job, new baby, yeah.
Yeah, game on.
What about you, Stephen? New baby in April?
Yeah, in a very rare situation of, you know, normally I'd be like, well, I'm, you know, working on a .. article, book, something, got a group together, we're going to stage the revolution, but it's looking, shaping up to be a quiet year, which is a dangerous state to be in, to be honest.
I can already hear all the silent screams of thinking of the notion of a new baby being described as a quiet year. I think you may be made to eat those words to a certain degree.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's been an interesting chat to pick up on what's stood out to us throughout the course of this year. Before we wrap up, I would like to give our final shout out to the patrons who have been supporting the Teachers Education Review podcast throughout 2022. We did open up Patreon in March of this year. And as we have indicated on the page, if you sign up as a highly accomplished patron, to reference that Holt accreditation, if you sign up as a highly accomplished patron, at the end of every month, we like to thank you and acknowledge your support. And so to end the year, our final and special thanks go to Jess Hollard, to Lee, and to Malcolm Young, all of whom have been supporting us at that highly accomplished level for most of 2022. If you'd like to join up and join their ranks and get a regular shout out on the TER podcast, you can go along to patreon.com/TER podcast or look for the link in the show notes to this episode. And we would love to have you join us and get involved in our interviews and conversations as patrons are able to do. Other than that, Tom, Stephen, thank you for a great year. Thank you for your contributions to the ongoing podcast and to this episode. All the best for the holiday season, and I'll see you at the beginning of 2023.
Cool. Cheers. Thanks, Cameron. You too.
Well, that's the end of this episode. And until next time, this has been the Teachers Education Review.
Thank you for listening to the Teachers Education Review. All opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual speakers only and do not represent the views of their employers or any other affiliated organisations. For links, show notes, and information on how you can contribute to the Teachers Education Review, be sure to visit terpodcast.com.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au